History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it before it's too late. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do that, we're educated, we're always entertained, and we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. That generation, as we all know, is dwindling. Of the more than 16 million who served in World War II, only about 40,000 are still with us. And most of them were the younger ones who got into the action later in the war. That includes the newly minted centenarian we're going to hear from today, and maybe this will help put it in perspective too. As for those who were there for the day that brought America into World War II, it's believed that only 11 men who were on Oahu on December 7, 1941, when Imperial Japan attacked Pearl Harbor and other installations, are still with us today. And speaking of, if you haven't seen it yet, you have to check out the moment this week when 102-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor Chuck Kohler was honored at a Michigan State basketball game. Chuck lives in California's Bay Area, but his great-grandson Jackson is one of the Spartan stars who's going to be playing in March Madness as college basketball reaches its crescendo. It won't take you long to find on social media or a search engine. Again, his name is Chuck Kohler, Pearl Harbor survivor. But the man we get to visit with today was a college basketball star once upon a time and a college baseball star. He played baseball professionally, became a Hall of Fame coach, sending quite a few of his players to the big leagues, including one of the greatest pitchers of all time. This gentleman produced a staggering number of holes in one on the golf course and shot his age more times than you'll ever believe. But none of that would have ever happened if he didn't survive the Battle of Okinawa in World War II as a teenager. Len Bordet turned 100 years old this past Friday, March the 6th. He shared his story on Hometown Heroes way back in 2008 when he was just 82, but I got to catch up with him some more this week in Fresno, California, which he has called home since 1948. This is actually a collaboration today with a podcast that the athletic department at his alma mater, Fresno State, produces called The Pod with host Taylor Martinez. So you're going to hear some of that mixed in with that original conversation from way back when. If you want to watch the full video of The Pod, you can visit gobulldogs.com/podcasts, and I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. But we had Coach Bordet start out with some of his earliest memories.
I grew up on a farm. My parents didn't own the farm, but we rented the house on the farm, and my brother and sister and I went to a two-room country school in an area outside of Hollister called Southside. So that was the beginning of our schooling. And then from there, my dad at that time was with the Shell, delivering gas to farmers in that area for Shell. And then he got the same job at Standard Oil. We moved to town and finished our schooling in Hollister at the grammar school and middle school and high school. Well, I didn't finish high school in Hollister. I finished high school in Napa because of the war.
Mm-hmm.
From there, I went into the service for 2 years.
And I want to ask you about Pearl Harbor Day, but I'm guessing because Taylor and I talk to these student athletes now, and their pastimes are playing video games with each other, or maybe they're watching television. They're looking at TikTok or social media.
Growing up, I probably spent a lot of my time with the working on my grandfather on my mother's side had a orchard, so there was always chores to do there, and we spent time working in those things, and then you know what kids do, swimming, playing, whatever they do in the country.
How did you start playing basketball?
Well, basketball was not very popular in Hollister at that time. They had no gymnasium, and we practiced out on a dirt court in football shoes.
In football shoes?
Yeah, so you wouldn't slide around on the on the asphalt or the gravel and stuff. So and then if we had a game, they had a little auditorium downtown Hollister. The roof was only about 25 feet high. So the games were played down there, and the practices were on the dirt at school. So, but that was my start at basketball. And then I really didn't start getting too serious about basketball until I went to Napa. And Napa, during the war, were carrying on all their sports, where Hollister was eliminating sports.
Mm.
So I got to Napa, made the basketball team. And as I progressed through the military, I made the basketball team at Fort Ord, but that didn't make any difference. I kept getting shoved out to training camps. I went to Texas for basic training, and I came back out to the West Coast, Fort Ord, and then ended up in Fort Lewis, Washington, and then I was shipped overseas.
And I'm just curious before that, because it seems like everybody who was alive then remembers December 7th of 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you found out about Pearl Harbor?
Yeah. I was on a 9-hole golf course just outside of Trespinas.
Oh, yeah.
You know where Trespinas is?
I do, yeah.
It's south of Hollister. A little 9-hole course there, and I was caddying for my dad.
He had decided to go out with a couple of his friends to play some golf on that Sunday morning, and he took me along to kind of go along as a gopher and a caddy, and about midway through our round, we got the news.
Cars stopped on the highway that goes right alongside the golf course, telling us that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. So that's how I found out.
Had you ever heard of Pearl Harbor before?
Not really.
Did that mean anything to you at the time? Did you realize how significant that was?
Not really. I know it wasn't very good for our country, but I don't think I really realized at that time in my life that it was that significant.
You were just about, 15 years old then?
Yeah, I think it was about 14, 15, yeah.
So you knew that you wouldn't be going into the service right away?
Well, I wasn't too concerned at that time. Of course, as things went along, it changed.
Did your brother end up in the service before you?
Yes, he did. He went in a little before me and was an Air Force cadet at one time, and then went on into the regular Army at a later time. I got drafted in summer of 44 into the Army.
Everybody has a welcome to the Army moment. For some people, it's boot camp was enough to tell them, this wasn't the kind of adventure I was looking forward to. Others, it's that first taste of combat. Was boot camp fun for you as an athlete? Were you prepared for the kind of grueling things they'd put you through?
Yes, actually, having a background being in pretty good shape most of my life and through high school, but I got into the Army and there was a lot of physical training, and I handled that with ease. And in my background in Hollister, we did a lot of hunting, and when we went on the rifle range, I became an expert with the rifle, and so my background kind of led me to somewhat enjoy basic training.
Wow, that is unique. That's a rarity for most of the veterans I talk to. But you talk about your marksmanship. I guess that made you natural for the Deadeye Division, as the 96th Infantry Division would come to be known as.
Well, I don't know. I think maybe it was just a warm body that they were looking for. But I did cherish the thought of being an expert with the marksman.
Now, have you heard the story of how the 96th Infantry Division came to be known as the Deadeye Division?
Not really. I did not know that history behind that.
Well, I don't know if this is the authoritative version, but what I was able to find in researching it was that Brigadier General Claudius M. Easley, a man with an established reputation as an Army rifle coach and sharpshooter, was eventually named the Assistant Division Commander for the 96th, and so he was determined. He made it his mission to train that division with superior marksmanship. And it said, at least in retrospect, that the 96th earned that nickname, the Deadeye Division, because of the General Easley and his Deadeye determination to make you guys good marksmen.
Okay.
Had you heard of him before, General Easley?
Yes, I've heard of General Easley, yes. I didn't originate with the 96th Division. I joined them on the battlefront in the Pacific as a replacement, so I did not leave the United States with that division.
When you're heading out toward the Pacific, what kind of things are going through your mind? Because at this point in the war, you've seen a lot of headlines. You've probably seen some newsreel clips. You know that it's not always pretty out there, and there's some pretty intense things, not to mention the fact that your brother had seen action in Europe.
Yeah. Well, we hadn't communicated all that much between each other, but the longer we got into the shipping overseas and landing on Hawaii and then going on to Saipan, and the further away from home we got, the closer we got to the battlefront. And of course, these battles were all going on, Iwo Jima and all those islands out there. And so, it got to be a little scary from the standpoint of going into combat.
And when you did go into combat, what was your understanding of what kind of duties you would have?
Well, they weren't really defined. I came out of training as an infantryman, and of course I was assigned, when I got over there, I was assigned to an infantry battalion. But in a battalion, you have four or five companies, and four companies of infantrymen that go right out on the line, and then there's one company that has heavy weapons. And it wasn't my choice. They just said, M Company, heavy weapons, needs X number of guys, and I happened to be one of the guys that were sent there. So I didn't have a choice what I was going to do.
Yeah, it's funny how that works in the Army, huh? They don't always let you tell them what you want to do.
Right.
And they also say never volunteer for anything.
That's right.
In the Army.
I got a story about volunteering.
All right.
I was inducted out of Napa, California, and was sent to San Francisco before we went on down to Monterey. And we were all, a bunch of recruits were in this big hall, just kind of sitting around. And this guy came in, and this sergeant came in, and he says, how many of you guys know how to type? And of course, I was just out of high school, and I'd had a business course, and I could type, so I quickly raised my hand. And so he took us, and we ended up cleaning the latrines in the depot.
There aren't any letter keys on a latrine, as far as I know.
Right.
So they basically just suckered you into volunteering.
Right.
Huh?
That's the last time I volunteered for anything.
I think I would learn that lesson, too, the hard way.
And Taylor, it's kind of crazy because I'm thinking again about the student-athletes you talked to who are 18, 19, 20 years old. At the time, all the Bulldog student-athletes quickly joined the war effort. Many of them shipped off to sea, overseas. There wasn't a football team in 1943. All these crazy changes. And here you were 15 years old, and all of a sudden, you'd already told us about getting into the Army, getting drafted. And I think when you got to the Battle of Okinawa, you had just turned 19 years old.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that time, everybody was getting shipped in there, so they were losing a lot of troops. And kind of luckily, I was trained as a infantryman, a rifleman.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got assigned on Okinawa, they assigned me to a heavy weapons company. I never ever worked a machine gun or anything like that. So, but I think I was lucky.
It's a battle that I think a lot of people are familiar with, a very bloody battle, one that was pretty drawn out, one that required quite a few replacements. And you were one of those replacements at Okinawa. This was the first time that you got into a taste of combat. Do I have that right?
That's right. We went in there about 5 days after they had landed. Army and the Marines jointly. One branch, Marines went north, the Army went south, and luckily for the Marines, they got the easy end of the island at the beginning, Of course, we all got into it at the end, so there's no gloating over whether we were better than they or not. But it was the way the thing was laid out.
What was going through your mind when you're heading off of a ship, going to shore, and realizing, okay, this is for real. There are going to be guys shooting at me, and it's my job to make sure that that our gun has ammunition to shoot at them. I imagine that's something that kind of keeps you up at night.
Yes, it was somewhat disturbing. We were landing and put us on trucks and headed for the front. And along the way, of course, with the amount of casualties that were being taken there, that many of our comrades were in body bags laying along the road, waiting to be taken back to the back area.
And, so that's one of the first things that you see when you get there.
Yes, that was
your fellow soldiers,
right?
Dead.
Right. So, it was somewhat disturbing, and you know, thoughts run through your mind. Well, I may be in one of those body bags too before too long. So, it was definitely thought provoking.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with now 100-year-old Len Bordet of Fresno, California. He drove himself to the baseball park where we recorded this latest interview, by the way. More of his story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to catch up again with Len Bordet, who's celebrating his 100th birthday this weekend in Fresno, California, with family, friends, and many of the ballplayers he coached in a 31-year career as the baseball coach at Fresno City College, where he won over 700 games, 4 state championships, and sent so many players on to professional success. But 81 years ago right now, he was marking his 19th birthday and about to enter his true trial by fire in the Battle of Okinawa. I want to again thank Taylor Martinez and Matt Murphy from Fresno State for collaborating this week with the podcast they produce called The Pod, honoring a man believed to be the oldest living former player for Fresno State in basketball as well as baseball. Let's jump back into Len's story.
When you say you're lucky, you know how many Americans died in that battle at Okinawa. And I know you had some close calls.
Yeah, it was astronomical. I've been very fortunate.
And you were assigned as an ammunition runner for a 30 caliber machine gun?
Yes. We had in a squad like that. There's a gunner and a turret carrier, and then there's I think there's six ammunition carriers, and you carry. Metal boxes of bands of rounds of 30 caliber ammunition.
How heavy of a box are we talking about? How much were you carrying it?
Oh, I would say that they're in the neighborhood of probably 25 pounds, something like that. I couldn't tell you actually, but you just carry them very far, you know you're carrying something.
And so you're waiting for a signal from the the commanding officer of that squad?
Yeah, well, you usually have the guy on the gun actually when the turret person he's feeding ammunition in there, and then when he gets low they call for ammunition, and then who's ever in line takes up what he's carrying, and whatever they need, you try to get it up to him.
What kind of a pace are you taking in such an instance, and what kind of terrain are you having to deal with?
Well, it varies. Usually it's was very mountainous and rocky, so you were always traversing over rocks and very little flat land.
Had you spent time growing up in Hollister, going up to the Pinnacles and exploring around there?
Oh yeah, I've been up to the Pinnacles numerous times, crawled around in the caves up there. And so
did this compare in Okinawa?
No, it was a lot worse in Okinawa than it is in the Pinnacles.
No one was shooting at you in the Pinnacles.
That's right.
What was that like as you're running this ammunition up to the gun or back and forth from wherever you're going? What's the atmosphere? Are there shells flying through the air? Are you hearing constant gunfire? Are you hearing screaming? Describe it for us.
Yes, actually, they say the ones that hit you, you don't hear. But the ones that are missing you have a definite popping and snapping sound. When they're going over you, you can really tell. So luckily, I could hear most of the ones that came around me.
Did you get the feeling that it was just a matter of time before one of them did hit you? Is that a thought that went through your mind?
Oh, yeah. There's always, your people in your company, even in your squad, are getting hit either by small arms fire or shrapnel from mortar shells or artillery shells. The thing about heavy weapons, those water-cooled heavy duty 30s, when you fired them, they would throw up a barrage of steam or smoke, and all of a sudden, that kind of puts a mark on where you're shooting from. So
kind of gives you away, doesn't it?
You don't want to stay in one place too long.
Yeah, I guess that was the advantage of the air-cooled machine guns, huh? They didn't have a cloud of steam.
Yeah, they still smoke a little.
Was it your experience that those, and I know you weren't having to fire the gun yourself, but was it your experience that generally they worked the way they were supposed to, or did you ever have to deal with a crew where it wasn't working?
No, actually, I never experienced, or our gun never seemed to break down or quit working. It always seems to be in good enough repair to do what it was supposed to do, and that was to lay down cover fire for the infantry guys up in front of you.
Probably some of whom were some of your buddies, guys that you'd gone through training with or certainly
one or two, not too many. It's amazing how they can separate you. You go through basic training with a bunch of guys and you hardly ever see them again.
And you hope you don't see them in a body bag.
Yeah, right.
Now, this was a long battle. This was 82 days is how long the battle lasted.
Yeah.
How much of that were you there for?
We were probably in for about 55 days.
That's quite a long time.
Yeah.
Did it seem to be pretty steady as far as the intensity? Were there lulls in the action? Did you ever think, oh, maybe it's almost over?
Yeah, you kind of got that feeling once in a while. There's a little bit of lull, but it seems like when we were on the offensive moving forward, then all of a sudden they would counterattack, and then that would stymie our troops, and we'd have to dig in and try to hold the ground we'd already taken. So it was kind of back and forth for a while.
Now, I imagine if you're there for about 55 days, and that's just about 2 months for those who couldn't quite do that math, there had to be some close calls in there for you. Give me an example of a close call of a time where maybe your position was hit, you were almost hit, or you thought, wow, that was a little too close.
I think the one time that disturbed me the most was that I had become what they called a runner for our company captain, mm-hmm. and I was with him, and we were behind a escarpment, and he had his field glasses, and he was looking to see what was going on over in another area, and all of a sudden, a bullet from a Japanese sniper caught him dead center on the top of the helmet, and it penetrated right through the helmet, and he deceased at that point right there, and he fell over on top of me.
Holy moly.
And I happened to be down lower than he was, and that was really one of the real disturbing things that I encountered.
Well, if you hadn't been lower than he was, then you might have had one between your eyes,
I
too.
Might have, yes. Could have.
What do you do in a situation like that? Is it your job then to try to get him back somewhere?
There's always medics, mm-hmm. out in the field like that, and what you do is you start yelling for medics, and someplace, somewhere, they always seem to show up and take over for the wounded and the ones that are hit very badly.
Now, when something like that happens, and I don't want to dwell on it too much, but is that something that affects you emotionally, or do you try to harden yourself so you're not affected by things like that because you know they're going to happen?
Well, kind of both. I don't think you ever get hardened to the fact that you witness somebody that's close to you getting killed. But it's on your mind, but you still try to perform the duty that you're assigned to do and go on with it the best you can.
I imagine when you're carrying a 25-pound package of ammunition, it's not too easy to reach for a sidearm or anything like that. But I imagine you were armed. You did have weapons.
Oh, yeah, we were armed with usually a small 30-caliber carbine, mm-hmm. that could sling over your shoulder. And
Did you ever have to use it?
Not to the extent of actually firing it at a enemy. Sometimes they ask you to lay a cover of fire, mm-hmm. so you fire out across a certain area. So as far as aiming it right directly at an enemy, no, I never did that.
Now, when did you get the sense that battle was drawing to a close? The war is obviously winding down. The war is over in Europe already. You're still fighting in the Pacific. How did you get the word that this Battle of Okinawa, the biggest amphibious assault in the Pacific during the war, this battle that lasted for 3 months, is finally coming to a close?
Well, you kind of get the feeling as the fighting forces move down towards the end of the island that things were beginning to turn in our favor, and we're getting less counterattacks and that sort of thing. So the word filters down pretty quickly in those kind of situations.
Did a moment ever come in Okinawa where there was some rejoicing that we have victory, this is over, we're leaving, or was it too somber of an occasion?
No, we had those moments of excitement about it being over, and then when it finally was declared secured, we moved into what they called an R&R recreation type of situation, where they allowed us to have some softball games and that sort of thing.
That was right up your alley, huh?
Yeah, I like that.
And I understand, Coach, that at the end of that, the battle's over, the island's secure, and you and some of your buddies decided, let's have a little fun. There's these caves. Who knows what's in these caves? Not rattlesnakes like in the Pinnacles, but maybe something more fun. Tell me about what you guys did.
Yes, we were looking for things to do, so four or five of us decided we'd reconnoiter up in some of the caves that the Japanese has occupied during the battle. And we ran across a medical situation up in the caves, and rummaging around there, we found some things that we'd like to take. And one of them was they had some containers of 100% pure alcohol, so... We thought, well, that'd be good, so we dumped all the water out of our canteens and filled them with this alcohol, and we returned to the camp and went down to the mess hall and got some grapefruit mix and stuff from the cook, and we thought we'd have a real big party, and it turned out that we had too much party, and we got rid of that alcohol real fast.
And you probably went to sleep real fast,
yeah,
too. That's some pretty strong stuff. And smells like trouble. But you survived that as well, thank the Lord. And while a lot of the 96th Division got to come home, you didn't have enough points, so you had to stay in the Pacific.
Right. As the war ended, we were shipped down to the Philippines to start training for the invasion of Japan. And on our way down, we were in a convoy, and we got word that the war had ended because of the atomic bomb. And
you'd probably never heard of an atomic bomb before,
never,
right?
Never. And, of course, we were all very excited, but then our excitement kind of turned to fear because at that particular moment, a wayward Japanese submarine got inside the convoy and started shooting torpedoes at some of the boats. And luckily, we had some Navy vessels that came in and dumped some depth charges and got them out of there. So we survived that little scare.
What was that like on the ship? Because obviously, you guys aren't trained to defend a ship. You're kind of helpless in that situation, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. You just sit and wait to see if something's going to hit you. So get your life jacket on and see what happens.
Wow. But thankfully, they didn't get you, and the war was indeed over. And you finally got to come home? Did you come home right away?
No. Actually, we went on down to the Philippines on the island of Mindoro, where we set up kind of a recreation-type camp. And then I was assigned to the 86th Division. Being an infantryman, I thought I was going to be assigned to the infantry part of that division, but lo and behold, I was assigned to the Ordnance Division of the 86th, and went into working in the motor pool. And I was assigned to re-shoe brake shoes.
Do you remember what it was like when you got back home to California? Saw your mom and dad again? Saw your brother?
Oh, yeah, it was a great feeling. Of course, in those days, they were sending us home on ships. And, nowadays, you jump on an airplane, and matter of depending how far away you are, you're home in hours. It took us about 7 days to get home, so we had a lot of time on the ship. And then when we got back to California, and they assigned us to a camp up north of Sacramento for our mustering out situation. So it wasn't a grand and glorious thing. It was just get in there and hopefully to get out.
It's time for our final break, but when we come back, more of now 100-year-old World War II veteran Len Bordet's memories from a legendary career in baseball and beyond. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. March 10th is coming soon, and that's when the new World War II book, The Dangerous Shore, hits the shelves. Here's Sarah Vladek, author of the New York Times bestseller Indianapolis, on what makes this new book so unique.
What I tried to do with this story is really take you through the eyes of those individuals who were pivotal in fighting the war on our shores. And they're everyday people. They're not these, you know, war heroes. They're the super nerdy, half-blind scientists, and the woman who's a double agent spy, and the mafia. I mean, the mafia played a huge part. We had no attacks in New York, and we had no union or labor strikes because of the mob, and they worked directly with naval intelligence.
Learn about some of the unsung and under-the-radar heroes of World War II and put yourselves in their shoes in The Dangerous Shore by Sarah Vladek. It won't reach shelves till March the 10th, but you can pre-order right now on Amazon.com. Just search for The Dangerous Shore.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and an episode mixing highlights from an interview when this program was pretty new almost 20 years ago, with one conducted this week with now 100-year-old World War II veteran Len Bordet, who most people know for his legendary career in baseball.
As I said before, my dad had been transferred during the war to Napa, and then when I was in the service, he got transferred to Fresno. And so when I got out of the service, I went to the bus station in Sacramento, and I said, give me a ticket to Fresno. And I'd never been to Fresno in my life. So I got on the bus and came down to Fresno, and my mom and dad picked me up at the bus station. And so I was living here in Fresno for a short period of time. And, of course, my thoughts were to get back with my old buddies that I had grown up with in Hollister, who had also been in the service. So I immediately told my mother and dad that I'd like to go back to Hollister and move in with my grandparents and go to San Benito County Junior College. So that's what I did.
Played some sports there?
Oh, yes. I played football, basketball, and baseball there for 1 year.
My basketball coach there thought I had a lot of potential, so he was a star player. I think it was University of Pacific at that. So he recommended that I try to go get in a four-year program. He wasn't the reason I came to Fresno State. The reason I came to Fresno State, my very good friend who I worked for his dad on the ranch was recruited by Kenny Gleason, the head football coach, for football. And so he talked me into coming over here with him because he didn't want to come alone. They were housed out at Hammer Field. They had a big cafeteria out there that the military had left behind. So anyway, he came and I came with him, and he only lasted a couple of weeks and went back to Hollister and married his girlfriend. And was a very successful rancher over the years. He's long gone now. So I stayed on and went out for basketball, which Dutch Warmerdam was the new coach. We played at an old gym at Hammer Field. The floor was rotting, and you'd be dribbling the ball like this, and then the ball wouldn't come up. And all our games were either at Fresno High School or Roosevelt.
Wow.
Fresno didn't have a gym.
Wow.
What are some of your favorite memories from your years playing basketball here?
We lost a lot. we had fun. We had some real good trips at that time back into the Midwest and played some well-known universities back there, and wasn't too successful. I think we were 0-5 on the trip.
Did you have to take a train there?
Yeah, we went on the train, yeah.
Uh-huh. And your coach... A lot of people don't know that Dutch Warmerdam coached basketball at Fresno State. They know he was voted the greatest pole vaulter of the 20th century. He jumped 15 feet on a bamboo pole 100 and something times before anyone else in the world did. But what was he like as a basketball coach?
Oh, he was, I think it was probably the second best thing to coach for him, other than track. I wouldn't call him a great basketball coach, but he was, you know, he was a very stern guy that kept you online and made you work hard, and but I enjoyed being with him. And I was, after I was through playing there and later in life, I became very good friends with him. In fact, did some card games and things like that on special occasions. And yeah, he was very good, and played golf with him.
Taylor, you'll never guess how many holes in one this guy has hit.
How many?
Take a guess. What do you think? What would be reasonable for anybody that plays golf a lot? Like, most people never get one, right?
Maybe five.
Five's a pretty good number. What's the number, Coach?
14.
14.
And I just have to ask, because your Bulldog basketball coach was this legendary pole vaulter, did any of you guys ever try to get him to teach you how to vault?
No.
Weren't crazy enough for that.
Yeah. It was a very humble person, Dutch was. You know, he fairly quiet, not really outspoken. But I enjoyed my time with him as a coach and also as a friend.
How did you start playing baseball?
Well, there was no Little League or any of that at that particular time. So it was just kind of a street game, you know, empty lot game. And just going out, getting a few guys together. And I used to drive my mother crazy because I was always... I was always throwing the ball up, whether it's in the house or wherever. I was always throwing the ball up and throwing the ball against the concrete steps in front and fielding the ball. And so I was always eager to play baseball. I was a walk-on at Fresno State, and it was Pete Biden's first year. It was Dutch's first year in basketball and Pete Biden's first year in baseball. So I walked on and I said, I want to try out for the team. And she said, okay, lad. So anyway, that's how I started. And had been at Napa High School, I got to play baseball because they had, even during the war, they had teams. And I played third base for the Napa High School team. And then when I came to, and then I played shortstop at the junior college in Hollister. And then when I came over here, I decided to try out for third base. And so I made the team as a third baseman. And then Pete saw something a little bit better in me, and he switched his shortstop to third base, put me at shortstop. So that was the beginning of my shortstop career at Fresno State for 2 years, and then I played 4 years in professional baseball for playing shortstop. So.
And Pete Biden's name is on the stadium, of course, but for people who never had a chance to meet him, what made him unique as a coach?
Well, Pete was a different guy. Had a short memory. Yeah, he was, never knew every guy's names, and he would call the guys he couldn't bring up their names. He would say Dooflopper.
Dooflopper.
Yeah, he says Dooflopper. He was a really great fundamental coach. I mean, when I went into professional baseball, I didn't learn anything I hadn't already learned from Pete. Mm. He was outstanding, great coach.
And you mentioned pro ball. Did you have visions of being a major leaguer? Is that what you thought your future might be?
Well, I think anybody that signs professionally has got way back in the back of their mind, you know. But so I signed with the Cubs. Sioux Falls, South Dakota was in the Northern League. They needed a shortstop. So since I was a utility guy in Des Moines, they sent me to Sioux Falls for the rest of that season. I had a good year that year. My story, you probably heard it. I've told it a lot. My main claim to fame is Henry Aaron beat me out as the all-star shortstop in the Northern League.
By one vote, I think, right?
I don't know what. Yeah, I think it was. Was close.
And how old was he at the time?
Well, I think it was 17.
He was a 17-year-old shortstop.
Yeah.
Were there any signs that he was going to be the all-time home run king?
He could hit. He could hit.
How did you get into coaching?
Well, I first, during my student teaching, I was giving a lesson to a group of students at Roosevelt High School. And the head of the Fresno Unified School District, PE and Athletics, was Jimmy Bradshaw.
Former Fresno State football coach?
Yeah. And he came in the gym. I didn't know he was in the gym at the time, but I was given all of these coaching directions and putting on a pretty good lesson. That evidently impressed him, because when the opening at Fresno City College, he elected, after turning down Ollie Bidwell, who had the big Fresno State Fresno High School team.
Fresno High apparently had the greatest high school team in American history with four future big leaguers, and Ollie coached them. So he turned down Ollie Bidwell to hire you?
No.
Oh, okay.
Ollie turned them down.
I got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so my name popped up, and then Bradshaw decided that I would be the next Fresno City College baseball coach.
And four state championships, all these big leaguers. And I wonder, because I've heard some of those guys talk about the kind of ball players they were. Mark Gardner's talked about how he went there as a shortstop, I think.
Yeah.
And you made him a pitcher.
Well, he made himself a pitcher.
Because he couldn't hit?
Yeah. he couldn't make it as an infielder, so he decided to try pitching.
But you had a guy early on who went on to be one of the greatest pitchers of all time. Some would say the greatest modern pitcher of all time, Tom Seaver.
Yeah.
What was he like then when you had him, before USC, before the major leagues and the no-hitters? What was he like at Fresno City?
He was a joker.
Yeah?
Very intelligent. Knew what he wanted to do. You know, the story. He went into the Marine Corps.
Right.
Out of high school as about a 5'8" or 955-pounder and came out 6'1", 190-pounder. And when he came out, he came to me and he said, "I want to come to City College for 1 year, and then I want to go to USC. I said, "Come on." So that's what he did.
Hmm. Yeah. And he was pretty dominant?
Yes, it was. I think it was 11-1, I think. And, We actually should have won the state that year, too. Great person. He kept the boys loose. He was always on the end of a joke or on top of a joke. I haven't really done a whole lot of things after I quit coaching. I basically turned myself over to the golf course. I think one thing I did on the golf course that might have lengthened my lifespan is that I walked. I walked all the time, never rode. Walking, 3-4 miles, 4 or 5 times a week, had to do some good.
How long ago did you hang it up?
Probably about a year.
Were you still shooting your age?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
My age or under, I think I did it something like 900 sometimes.
He shot his age 900 and something times.
Really?
I did it first. I was 73 when I first shot my age.
Yeah.
So I thought, I'll just keep putting down the scores as I go out and play.
And I learned something today about you that I didn't know. There's an old drawing of you from the Fresno Bee back in the late 1940s that has you playing basketball and baseball. It said you were a steer roper, too?
Yeah, not a championship air roper, but the ranch, the fellow that I told you I came here with,
yeah.
Alan was the header, and I healed.
I'm just wondering, after hearing all these stories, what haven't you done or what can't you do? It doesn't seem to be a very long list.
Well, I can't play golf anymore. That's all that. Then the balance is, can't keep balance.
And I know you're going to get to celebrate your 100th birthday with family and a bunch of your former players and all that. When you think back over 100 years, 100 full active years, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Yeah, probably coming out of my military experience, especially Okinawa, with the kind of casualties, et cetera, that they were experiencing there. I didn't realize it at the time, but as I look at it, I could be on Okinawa right now.
A lot of Americans were. They never came home.
Very grateful for the chance to go on from that experience.
And it's been about a decade now, but you went to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight.
Yeah.
And you got to honor all those who died in the war and the other wars. That's something that our community continues to make possible through their donations. Was there something about that experience that had special meaning for you?
Yeah. Another person that went on that flight is a good friend of mine, has been for years, Merle Martin. He was a tail gunner on a B-25 bomber in the European theater. I think he flew 25, 30 missions. So he was on that, and we enjoyed going through all the things that we did during knowing each other at school and after school.
I'm sure a lot of coaches have asked you for advice over the years. And everyone tries to reinvent the wheel when it comes to coaching. If there's a coach out there listening to this, what's the number one piece of advice you can give him for being a good leader?
Well, that's kind of a hard question to answer. I would say that to be upfront and be honest and be willing to give all the players that you're concerned with good recognition, and not just, be tuned into the stars. You take a team like Fresno State right now, you must have 25, 30 guys. They're not playing all those guys. So you're going to have some unhappy guys around, But if you can involve them in a manner that is making the team good.
What advice do you have for us if we want to get to 100 like you?
Walk.
On the golf course.
Whether it's baseball, basketball, steer roping, all those aces on the golf course, or just sitting down for a conversation, anybody who has the privilege of meeting Len Bordet comes away pretty impressed. And one of the things I admire most about Coach Bordet, having interacted with him off and on for 2 decades, is the selfless dedication he showed in caring for his late wife. They spent 72 years together. He's now 100, and as you can tell, still going strong. And keep your eyes peeled for that video podcast from Fresno State, The Pod. But that's all the time we have on the radio today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.